This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. It is BFM 89.9. I'm Khoo Sitrang, joined by my fellow Penangite, Joyce Goh. It is Tuesday, the 21st of November, 2017. And it never ceases to amaze me, Joyce, that every time I turn on the the news stock this morning and how time has flown by.
Yeah.
We're now in the last 2 months, the final leg of the year. It's quite astounding.
It's like a month plus over to year end.
Yeah, I know. How time flies when you're not having fun. What happens if you are having fun? While people were asleep overnight, many things happened, both serious and unserious. And I guess the latest from Zimbabwe and the kind of like coup no coup of Robert Mugabe, the 93-year-old dictator. Now he's undergoing impeachment proceedings. Apparently he let his wife Grace usurp constitutionally power. No less. And this motion is now due to be presented to Parliament on Tuesday. It's quite interesting because obviously leader of a country once prosperous in the 60s, now no longer prosperous because of all the transgressions, allowed his wife to take power.
Yeah, it's quite surprising what happened. And now everything's coming up, right? And so the senior party member there said that the process could take as little as 2 days to complete. And President Mugabe could be removed by Wednesday.
Yeah, exactly. I think what's happening is the army is saying that if they don't, the people are saying that if Mugabe doesn't vacate his seat peacefully, there will be social unrest. And of course, there would be social unrest if there's been 30-odd years of, plundering. Let's move on to another great piece of news, because that serial killer, that countercultural activist from the 60s, Charles Manson, who basically directed his followers to commit a string of brutal murders. He died in prison after nearly 40 years of incarceration. He was 83 years old, just 10 years younger than Robert Mugabe. But his demise, or his vacation, nonetheless welcomed.
Yeah. So he was admitted to the hospital there in California earlier this month and died of natural causes on Sunday, Chuang.
That's right. I think most famously, the Manson cult killers, the most famous victim was Sharon Tate, the wife of the very famous Polish film director, Roman Polanski. Mm. He's been a fugitive from the U.S. criminal justice system for statutory rape since those days. So life follows art, or art follows life sometimes. Mm. Again, lastly, Yana Novana, because if you're a tennis fan, you know this name, because Yana Novana, she was very famously a Wimbledon champion after losing twice in the final, one of them to Steffi Graf, I think. She finally won Wimbledon in 1998, but she's passed away from natural causes, because she has been, she was 49 years old when she passed away, and she's gone because of cancer.
Yes, and she was an inspiration. I think she played tennis really well at that time. Yeah, and together with, during the Steffi Graf days and all that,
tennis was
very, very big sport then, as it is now, but it's just the players now and then are quite different.
Do you watch any sport at all?
Tennis.
Really?
I play tennis.
Really?
Yeah.
We must have a game one day.
Do you play tennis?
I play tennis very well, actually.
But you must give me chance, because I haven't played in some time, but I represented the school.
Did you? Really? Well, you know the Yana Novotna now, and you watch.
No, no, no.
You don't know all.
No, I don't. I mean, I can't play as well, definitely. But Steffi Graf was, I really liked her.
All right. Well, we're going to come back with the, another blockbuster of information about how James Bond was the model employee. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, good morning. It is 6:07 a.m. It's bright enough to be bushy-tailed, I guess. I'm Khoo Sitrang, joined by Joyce Goh. That was Live and Let Die by Paul McCartney, and of course the title of the seminal 70s movie, James Bond, Live and Let Die, of the same name. I think this is a Roger Moore movie. Do you watch any Roger Moore, Joyce?
James Bond movies?
I almost called you James, Joyce.
J, same alphabet. Well, yeah. James Bond obviously is huge. Yeah, so the article we have here today is on how James Bond was the model employee.
He was.
Yeah,
he worked for the
secret.
Yeah, because he risked life and limb for essentially a salary of £1,500 a year. Okay, he never questioned his superiors. He never went up against M or Q or any one of these people. He just took what was given him, And he did it all for Her Majesty's Secret Service, wasn't it? Really?
Yeah. But do you think it's also because of the timing at that time during the 1960s when the writers were writing the movie? Was it 1950s, 1960s, at that time when writers were writing the movie, and how that has progressed to what James Bond is today is a bit different?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Look, I want to cite this example. A friend of mine who runs a media company, had a chat with him yesterday. He runs an internet company, one of the news organizations, one of the famous ones. And I shouldn't say the name because, you know, obviously, it implicates his staff, but you know, he said to this quite bright young girl who you know obviously was making writing good stories for him. He said that, you know, look, I mean, if you come on board initially when he hired her, right? He said, if you come on board, I can give you this salary, that salary. And you know what she said to him? She was only 25 at the time. She said, "I will try you for a year.
Wow!
I will try you for a year. Okay, I'll see how I feel, and then if I like it, I'll stay on."
Oh.
Right?
He hired her?
He hired her because obviously she came highly recommended, but she was only 25 at the time.
Well, and she's still there?
She's still there.
After how many years?
I think she's been there about a year and a bit now, a year and a half. And there's a promise of being seconded to another country and, you know, foreign coverage in Singapore or something. But still, I mean, how times have changed,
yeah,
right?
It's because changed, last time,
your boss says jump, you say how high and for how many times, right? Now, I will try you for a year, right?
Yeah, but do you think it's an age thing, but also culture, do you think? It has maybe when Asian culture at that time we were more
submissive. But this is British culture in the '60s, right? I mean, you know, James Bond, no less. He was a secret agent. He was a spy. He could read the Quran backwards if he had to, right?
So
that's how good he was,
so
right?
It's changing of times, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
But do you think so? The question here is: are we more critical and resentful nowadays towards authority in this day and age, or do you think it's a?
What do you think? I mean, you're a much younger person than I am. So
Thank you. Well, I think it's changing.
Is that a compliment? I don't know.
I'm not sure. That's a compliment, Joyce. Thank you very much.
Hey, hello, self-praise, no praise, hello.
You just praised me. I just took it. Yeah, but anyways, I think it is something that when it comes to bosses, I feel what makes a good employee, yes, if you take instructions, but also if you're productive, that's one. But I feel it's not good to surround yourself with yes men.
Correct, because that's the echo chamber, right? Mm. And if you surround yourself, I mean, the old adage is that if you surround yourself with people smarter than yourself, then the organization will benefit, right? But if you have James Bond is a different job description, clearly, because you're eliminating bennies. But if you're an employer in a corporate workforce, you want to have people that question you,
correct,
and that you can take you in a different direction.
But definitely there are bosses out there who like yes men. I mean, there are. They like that. They like the shoe polishers, the yes men.
I don't like shoe polishers. As soon as you say yes, but I say, why are you calling me boss? Because I've been both things, right? I've been employee as well as employee.
Yes, that's true. And do you find that sometimes a bit fake?
It's very fake because obviously they want something from you. But, you know, in a media organization, you want to have, for example, if you're an editor, right, and you have your weekly story meetings, right? And then one of your journalists says to you, oh, I'd rather, you know, or you say to them, you know, I think the story this week should be this and that.
Yeah.
And then it's music to one's ears. If you're like a progressive person to hear someone from your team say, actually, how about we discuss it? Because, you know, for these reasons, A, B, C, and D.
Yeah.
Then you think, well, if it holds water, why not, right?
Yeah, so you agree it's better than blind obedience or constant disagreement. What do you think is better? Not constant disagreement, but or blind obedience, but a mix of both.
Well, you know, horses for courses, right? You just don't want to have someone to question you all the time because it's, you know, cool and current and, you know, contemporary to be questioning your boss. You want to have them to question you with substance, right?
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Joyce, I don't think the story this week should be this. I think it should be that because of these reasons. And if those reasons are cogent, then why not?
Yeah.
Right?
Or sometimes they just want to... They just disagree just for the sake of disagreement to hold a different kind of thinking of view. Then, not.
Correct.
Not
I mean, those are the most irritating people in, you know, known humankind. But,
but I feel productivity is also important
as
an employee.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're going to come back with more interesting stories that rivets one's attention. The next one will be about an app that basically allows you to sleep and work in the same place. Good idea or bad? BFM 89.9. Good morning, BFM 89.9, 6:18 in the morning. I'm Khoo Soo Chong, joined by my fellow Penangite, Joyce Koh.
Good morning.
I almost called you James Bond earlier. I don't know why.
J&J.
So look, I mean, from James Bond to co-working spaces. And this is interesting because you know how last time, right? Hilton Hotels and Western, you know, all these five-star hotels, right?
Yeah.
They were disrupted by Airbnb.
That's right.
Because Airbnb was cheaper, right? Mm. So now Airbnb has become the expensive alternative because if you ever, I mean, have you used Airbnb
yes,
recently?
Yes, I have.
Not cheap anymore, right?
No, but it depends on the property. Depends on the unit they're looking at and which location and yeah. But the current one that we just booked, it's quite pricey.
It's quite pricey, right? And you know, three figures, four figures per night. But then now they are being disrupted because I've got this story from Motherboard, Joyce, motherboard.vice.com actually. Mm. It's content partner of Vice. And you know, basically now there's a company called Podchair. Podchair was started by a person called Elvina Beck and her father, right? So co-founded in 2012 by both these people who have now built shared living spaces for social travelers and mobile workers who rent the beds for $35 to $50 a night. But then during the day, these beds turn into desks, right? And you can, you've got your Wi-Fi connections, you've got your coffee places, you've got your napping stations. But basically, you can sleep there, and then when you wake up, you can turn your bed into a working space.
I see. So it's like co-living, co-working spacing. Would you do something? Would you go for that?
Sure. I can't think of a fate worse than that. I'd rather be electrocuted 12 times in a row.
But I see the convenience in this, especially when you're young and you're single and you have all you do is work. I mean, when you start out at work.
Yeah.
Do you remember your first job where you put in like the amount of hours that, I mean, every other weekend I was working?
Actually, my first job was a lot of fun.
Yeah?
Yeah, I was an internal auditor and I was working for a bank. Uh-huh. So I was, you know, auditing, bank branches around the country.
Mm-hmm.
So we used to fly all the time. We used to fly and take, you know, drive all over the country. It was a lot of fun.
Wow.
After a while, I got a bit bored because you never were at home, but it was a lot of fun. And that was my first job.
Well, my first job, that was not as fun, definitely.
You were in audit or something,
yeah,
right?
Audit firm. Doing tax, and it was like you were in the office every other weekend and working till late, because if you have peak periods, you know, peak periods are peak periods, right? So you're in the office all the time. And
audit is the worst kind of thing.
But
right?
I was doing tax, yeah. But they also have tax filing season. And yeah. So when it's
I used to work in a tax department. It was a bit like pulling teeth, actually.
Well, this one makes sense. I mean, I feel if you're young and you're single, you have time and you want to live near to the office, because this one is in US, right? In Los Angeles.
I think actually, to be honest, I think this is a great demographic to be targeting, because if you are young, free, and single, and you've just come to the city for the first time,
and
right,
you don't have a lot of money for rent,
correct,
or your mortgage,
correct,
for that matter.
And it's very exciting. It's almost romantic because you get to, you know, meet new people. You're going to meet a partner potentially, but then you can work together. It's all quite hippie-esque.
Yeah.
Hippie-esque, you know what I mean? Like in the 60s.
Yeah. You
had communes and stuff like that. Quite nomadic in nature. Because if you've got little pod chairs around the country, then you can kind of just go from place to place.
It's also picking up in Singapore. Did you know that, Chuang? So actually in Singapore, recently co-living spaces has picked up there. There's this one called Hamlet, that where users can find a room rental on a month-by-month basis with a minimum commitment of 3 months. So it's, you don't have to commit like long periods of time.
Yeah, exactly. You're not tied in.
And the rooms have basic necessities like water, electricity, internet, and even cleaning and ironing services.
So if I take you back, some years, not many compared to me, Joyce, would you do it?
Actually, it depends on where, like rental, if it's near my office, because I used to live quite far from the office. I used to travel and jam, you know, KL jam is really bad.
And
I would spend quite a long time in the commuting. So if it's near my office and it's affordable, why not?
So I think Podchair, because I'm on the site now, you know, they obviously, as a business model, they've got to choose quite central location. So there's a Podchair in Hollywood, there's a Podchair in Venice Beach. Cool place,
see,
right?
Yeah, these are all expensive places
cool
if you
places,
want to go. Yeah,
but cool
and
places,
expensive,
right. Quite arty, quite farty.
Yes.
Quite alternative. But then you can work there, right?
Yeah.
I think I'll do it.
Yeah, see? It's not that bad after all.
You're
electrocute yourself. I don't think it's that bad. And in Singapore, the cheapest room for Singapore is $900.
That's not cheap.
Yeah,
huh?
But I think that's because that comes with this for three months. It comes with other things. They throw in ironing, cleaning, internet. And Singapore, you must remember, rental there is not as cheap as well.
Oh, yeah.
Housing
it's,
there,
it's,
yeah.
It's a bit like,
yeah, and this could be right in, I don't know where it is, but it could be in CBD where the Orchard Road, who knows, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, you know, casting your mind back to those halcyon days when you were young and free and single. No longer the case for me, at least. I don't know about you, Joyce.
But, I am not single.
Actually, true. Yeah, yeah.
Nor
yeah.
am I that young. Yeah, yeah.
But compared to me, you're but nothing but a knee-high to a grasshopper. Anyway, so at 6:23 in the morning, we're going to be coming back with Southern Nights by Glen Campbell, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, 6:39 AM, that was Hit Me With Your Best Shot by Pat Benatar. And I guess that story, that title of that song could have been referring to this particular story from the Malaysian Insights, Joyce, because, look, I mean, nowadays social media is utilised as an instrument of, I guess, almost like propaganda, because like news events showing the various politicians going to you know, help aid victims or flood victims or whatever. And sometimes it's, it's an instrument for good, but in this particular case, some days ago, remember we saw Prime Minister Dato Sri Najib visiting Dato Sri Anwar Ibrahim in hospital, and they were looking quite happy in the picture.
Yes.
I think Anwar is ill in hospital, and obviously when this picture hit the internet, there was a lot of skepticism over the perhaps the politicization or the propaganda elements of this story. I mean, what do you think?
Well, there are two thoughts to this, right? One is whether there is anything behind this visit, whether or not this has been politicized, right?
In terms of strategy,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, whether there is something more than what you see, whether is it just for optics? And there's this other side of thinking where whether or not, where do we draw the line? Because maybe he's just going to visit Dato Sri Anwar
to
go and see him, but people think there's more to it, you know?
Yeah, it's a bit like when the floods hit Penang a few weeks ago and Guaning, you know, called Zahid, you know, it's, what is it, 3 a.m. in the morning, and basically they put aside the political differences to help people who are in strife, yeah?
Mm.
So I guess the issue is, A, whether or not one should put politics aside when a fellow colleague in the sector is ill, or B, whether it was just another political gimmick, you know, and maybe it's a bit of both, right? It's never as clear-cut as that.
Yeah, like you mentioned, Chuang, when it comes to social media, it's a very powerful platform, right? You reach so many people, and then again, you cut through the whole, because nowadays, when it comes to media, sometimes when it comes to certain publications, some people are a bit skeptical. So when it's social media, it's just it goes direct to the user, and it's up to you what you make out of it. No one can spin it for you.
Yeah,
it's what you see and what you think it is.
Correct. We've just sent out the tweets asking you the question, can political opponents be real friends? And I remember the grill I had with Tony Pua and Khairi Jamaluddin. They were both supposed to be political enemies, but it was like a proper bromance on air. So it's actually quite disconcerting because I never knew they were such good friends. So, I mean, what happens behind the scenes and what is in real, what is portrayed in public life is sometimes very, very different.
Yeah, it's very different.
Right?
Yeah.
So, but you know, obviously, there's a lot of healthy skepticism in the public arena, because when I saw the story in Malaysian Insight, there's a social media user called at @IMFC_Aruna. And he recounted events leading up to Anwar's second sodomy charge, for which he received a 5-year jail term in February 2015. And obviously, you know, there was lawyers present, there was basically alleged payments made to him, and at the end of the day, the conclusion drawn by this individual was political gimmicks.
Yeah, former Bar Council President and human rights activist Ambiga, also she tweeted and said that the visit was not okay. Quoting her, she said, "Not sure why people think Najib's visiting Anwar is okay. You torture a man, then visit when he suffers from it. Free him lah, then we talk." So,
yeah,
so a different
kind of
thoughts to this, right? Whether or not it's real or whether or not it's not, you know, yeah. But definitely, it's definitely gotten the whole social media buzz with it.
Right.
There was so much on Facebook, on Twitter, Instagram.
Yeah.
Everyone's like talking about it.
Because the people's reaction is a little bit like how, you know, it's a response to the games that to the games politicians play, right? Right,
yeah.
Because if you pander to different audiences and you say different things to different people, then people start to perhaps disbelieve you, right?
Question you, yeah.
It is, yeah. Okay, well, obviously, a story for another day and many a story which keeps on giving. We'll be back with more news, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, 6:48 a.m. That was Carnival by the Cardigans, one of the top hits of the day. I think 1993 or 1992.
In the 90s, definitely, yeah.
Yes, that was Joyce Go. I'm Khoo Soo-Chong, and we're going to be talking about this survey published, Joyce, by Singapore's ICS Yusof Ishak Institute, which has found that the majority of Johorians actually support bringing back English medium schools. Of the 2011-odd respondents, 82%, that's a massive 82% voiced their agreement, which actually has brought up the question, are we ready for it? So to get more insights on this, we spoke to Datin Azima of PAGE, which stands for the Parent Action Group for Education. We asked her if she thinks that the idea of bringing back English medium schools is a feasible move.
Well, when the Prime Minister and the Economic Council were looking for a radical approach towards the English language, which is part of the National Education Blueprint Phase 2, we were one of the organizations which were consulted. And one of the three things that came out of this consultation was that English medium schools should be revisited. But in the end, even though the government had decided that we should pilot English medium schools, the Ministry of Education decided that they were not ready for it. So I think it's time that we relook, because if anything, we can start small in the three states with zero resistance, which is Johor, Sabah and Sarawak. I think that we should tweak it in such a way that we do not antagonize the Malay ultranationalists.
We then asked her if there needs to be an overhaul of the existing system so that it fits into an English medium school's syllabus.
Well, as far as existing teachers are concerned, I think with Johor, I think that the English teachers there are of a different class altogether. And I think if the Ministry of Education with the Johor State Education Department could sit down together, I think it's very easy to get English medium schools to be piloted there, and they should open up probably an English medium school in every district and give the opportunity for students to have this other option. And also, we think that the same should be done in Sabah Sarawak, because Sabah Sarawak enjoyed 10 years of more English language, and plus the fact that they don't believe that Bahasa Melayu is their official language there. So I think it's not just Johor that should start English medium schools, but Sabah and Sarawak, I think, will be equally confident and hungry for such schools to be opened. There must be some kind of sustainability whereby these students who go to this special English medium schools are in turn offered the opportunity to go abroad to do their degree. You know, and we have to do things differently. Before, what happened was, you know, our Malaysian students would go to UK or wherever it is, Australia, US, and then they would stay among themselves and they will come back and they will not improve the English. So what we should do and insist on is that these students either stay in halls or stay with native speaker families, whereby immersion in English is 100%. So when they leave, for instance, the UK with their degree, English has become first language, and they speak as well as the native speakers. And I think this is the missing link. And when they come back, do their diploma education and then be a teacher.
Yeah, I think Datin has got very interesting views, Joyce, because obviously, you know, the whole theory of whether English should be spoken and learned is a reasonably well settled notion, because when you look at it, right, English as a language is spoken in about, you know, with about 340 million people around the world, but most notably in the centers of commerce like North America, the UK, Australia, Canada, Germany, obviously, not Germany, New Zealand, Australia, right? So those are the kind of like established G7 OECD countries. But then it's also then the next step is beyond that notion, then in terms of applying that principle. Now, I think Datin's got a point, because if you apply that to Johor, Sabah, Sarawak, those are the most receptive states, but then not necessarily the rest of the country. I mean, what do you think?
Well, it's also how they're going to execute it. How are they going to execute this if they're going to introduce English back to schools, like syllabus, to teachers? How prepared are they, right? And yeah, I agree, English medium schools is a feasible move, but how are they going to do that? Because, okay, if Johor, Sabah, Sarawak, just three states, and the other states are just the local, there's a mismatch, because if we're all one country, it's very difficult. Either you roll out everything or not. But looking at this current survey that was done for Johorians, obviously 82% is huge. Yeah. It has voiced up for this agreement, right? I mean, if we were to do this in for the whole country, who knows what it will be? Yeah, it could still be high as
correct.
Well.
Because in theory, if politicians and policymakers desire that outcome, mm-hmm. then they can do a hard and fast reset, right? For example, right. if you look at Narendra Modi with monetization mm-hmm. in India late last year, he just overnight declared it that the whole country had to fall in step.
Mm.
In Malaysia, you must have the political will because yes. there will be severe backlash from nationalists and, you know, ultra-nationalists. But if you understand, I mean, I think that is the notion. I mean, look at the Sultan in Johor. He's been very public in saying that, you know, Malaysia should abolish multi-stream schools because it doesn't foster unity. And we know that to be conceptually on the dot, but to do it, you must have the will.
Correct. And you can see in Johor that there is. But whether or not everywhere else in the country, whether or not there is, like you said, strong political will to do it. If there is, then yes, perhaps we can execute it.
Okay. Well, I mean, personal story, right? You know, me and a couple of friends have been toying with the idea of an English language school. We actually tried it. And we actually came across some interesting findings because we didn't think that, you know, particular sectors of society might be receptive. And in fact, we have proven quite the opposite. They were very, very receptive. And during the classes we conducted, they wanted more and more. And these guys were in various sectors of the economy. Quite a few of them were from hospitality. But obviously, if you're in the hospitality sector, you must be able to communicate with the guest, right?
Right.
And then some came from a corporate background. Some came from a manufacturing background. And all of them, bar none, wanted to learn English. And this all obviously is a Klang Valley thing, right?
Yeah.
But
you can see, like, if Johor, it's obviously there's demand. But I disagree with her when she said that when our kids go abroad to study, they stay with each other because of language. But no, I think we stick to each other because of just culture.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. You see, yeah.
Okay. Well, it's now 6:55 in the morning. We've got a song coming up from Coldplay, which is quite aptly titled Don't Panic, BFM 89.9. Good morning, 7:06 in the morning. I'm Koo Sujong, joined by Joyce Koh. Now, according to MCMC Minister Joyce, Dato' Sri Dr. Saleh Karawak, he said the internet has become the swing factor in elections. Politics and political campaigns are now much more dependable on the online and electronic media. And he also said that political parties started using the internet 10 years ago to sway public opinion. But it was not until now that Malaysians have realised the impact of the internet in swinging votes. Now, in his latest blog post, and he's an avid blogger, he cited media tycoon Rupert Murdoch as saying that by 2050, the media is going to be totally online or electronic and that the print media was going to be a thing of the past. But the minister also stressed that everybody must ensure that the integrity of the online media is not killed off due to the actions of a few. So to get more views on into the matter, we spoke to Jahabar Sadiq, the longtime journalist and founder of the Malaysian Insight. We asked what Jahabar thought about Sadiq's posting, how big of an impact the internet really does have on Malaysian politics at the moment.
It's a perception that the internet has a huge impact on Malaysian politics, particularly in social media. It's a bit of a circular logic here because all political parties seem to be spending a lot of money in sponsoring posts, advertising everywhere on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, you know, presence all over the place. And that just puts a whole perception that the social media and internet is full of politics and therefore you should add on more to it. I think most Malaysians are very fussy about what they read. They read what's going on and they make up their own minds. And whether they're influenced by the internet or not can only be seen by the amount of what they read is shared via WhatsApp or any other messaging chats. And I think it's not that much as far as I know from my circle of friends. But of course, my circle of friends are all above 30 years old. So obviously they're more politically inclined. You know, I think it's just this great fallacy that the internet is a great determinant. It's a great conduit of information and disinformation, but not a great influencer in my mind.
We then asked Jabba just how much politicians and parties in Malaysia have leveraged on online media to influence voters.
Okay, I think the fact is in the last decade, since 2008 elections, and going back beyond to the 1999 elections, a lot of political parties, particularly the opposition, have been using the internet. Started with blogs in 1999, went on to Facebook, which only came out in 2007, I think, and Twitter and all that. So, yes, I think that particularly in the last two elections, a lot of focus and investment has been made online. For the simple reason, there's a trust deficit when it comes to mainstream newspapers and also the electronic media like television or radio. Because in Malaysia, as you know, as a radio station yourself, you need a license. And news is somewhat regulated. So people actually rely on the internet for their information fix. And it won't stop. I mean, the fact that a 93-year-old man is already doing videos with smirks and eye rolls, and that's going around virally, it tells you a lot about how pervasive and to some extent intrusive the internet has been for politics in Malaysia.
Finally, we asked Jabba about the trust deficit in online news and if he sees a solution to upholding the integrity and transparency of online media.
The fact is, everybody's faking news. You know, people will take headlines and tweak it around with Photoshop and then just send it around using WhatsApp. And then it will go on forever. You can't change it. You know, for every news that is truthful or factual, there will be a piece that is not. They will tweak it. You've seen it in the American elections, French elections, you see it in the German elections. It will happen always. The fact of the matter is, it's up to the reader, the consumer, to determine and to read more to figure out what is really the news of the day and what is not news of the day. It's just like going to the market to buy something or another, right? You figure, okay, you know, if I pay a bit more, I'll get probably original coffee. If I pay less, I'll get a knockoff, some version from a country that is known for faking things, you see. So, I think the onus is actually on the consumer more than anything else to figure out what is factual and what isn't. Portals like ourselves, we do our best to be as factual and accurate as possible, because if we don't have the readership, we don't get the ads and we die. So it's always in our interest to be as factual as possible.
That was Jabba Sadiq, the founder of the Malaysian Insight, Joyce. And, you know, I mean, Jabba and I are former colleagues from Reuters. We've been around the corner a couple of times, been around the block a couple of times where media coverage is concerned. And I just want to reference the old paradigm whereby in the newspapers, right, Joyce, you know, you cover a story, then you've got your editor to have a look at your story, then you've got a couple of subs who go through your story. And if you have a breaking story, like I used to have in the newswires, it goes all the way to the top. So I had to get basically three levels of editors all the way to North America. And in the biggest stories, Matt Winkler used to, in fact, Michael Bloomberg himself used to approve or disapprove our stories. So that was the old world, right? In the new world, in the internet domain, what you write gets published straight away. So there's obviously a lot of leeway, right, Joyce, for disinformation to be published on the internet.
That's true, Chuang. And when you talk about editorial news breaks and all, I had worked with Jabba Sadiq for a news break as well that time when we were all under edge, when Malaysian Insider
under
was
edge under edge?
Under the edge group, right? And when you say yes, and the internet is all about breaking it fast. Like when you say, Chuang, when you were writing, it went all the way to the US for editing process, fact-checking. But when you're in currently now, when it's an online portal and you need to break the news fast and you're chasing the story, it needs to be fast, but we still have to get it right, as what Jabba said. I remember working with him on a story and we were fact-checking it all the way. But I mean fast, because we had to get the news out first. This was on a vaccination for kids. There was a drop in supply and we were working on that. And we had to fact-check, because at the end of the day, internet has come up and everyone's consuming news on the internet, social platforms, social media platforms and all that. So that some people have this view that it cuts the spin when it comes to traditional media. And like you mentioned, there's a trust deficit when it comes to mainstream and electronic media as well. It depends on the platform.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, it's very important to make sure that there's no trust deficit for the consumer. And from then you can gain the trust. And in a way, if people want to form a view, they form a view based on that news that you've put out. But if they don't trust you anymore, whatever you write and put out, whether it's an online platform, whether it's a print, whether it's a TV, radio, if there's trust is gone, it's gone.
And exactly. And I think even the internet tycoons, they know the importance of authenticity. And of course, they know the importance of track record, because that's the reason why Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post. And by the way, the Washington Post is the subject of a movie by the Meryl Streep, Catherine Graham, right? The legendary publisher. And that's why Jack Ma bought South China Morning Post, both in their personal capacities, right? So, I mean, the thing is, unfortunately, though, the media has always been biased one way or another. In the UK, whether you read The Guardian or whether you read The Times or whether you read The Financial Times, the owners always, I mean, Rupert Murdoch was a very famous, you know, for his leanings, right?
Yeah, speaking about media biasness, I've interviewed Dato' Wong Sai-wan. He is the EIC of Malay Mail
Newspaper.
Yeah, he's the EIC editor-in-chief. And you can listen to that podcast. You download it from our BFM app. And he spoke about how all media is biased one way or,
exactly.
or another.
And he's telling the unvarnished truth. It is 7:15 in the morning. We're going to be coming back with more news headlines, including oil prices, sandstorms, and more politicking. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.